Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. A timestamp here, it's currently the 24th of April 2020, and ISO life continues. And with all that is going on around the world right now, I thought it another good time to catch up with friend of the show, Six Park co-founder and co-CEO, Pat Garrett, and have a chat about financial markets and how that might be affecting and impacting your investments. We last spoke with Pat around a month ago in mid-March, and at the time I mentioned this quote from Morgan Housel, which I thought was quite appropriate at the time, and he said, "It's hard to remember a time when there was so little expectation of even slightly good news." Well, I'm not saying that we're through this, but we are starting to see some signs around the world that the curves, they are flattening, albeit there's still a lot to play out. Potential increases in the rates of infection, the sustained success of economic stimulus packages, business confidence, unemployment rate, and as people return to work. And if we're going to see any increase in some of the behaviour we're seeing overseas with people protesting their frustrations with the restrictions that isolation has been imposed on them. Fortunately, we haven't seen that kind of behaviour in Australia as of yet. Okay, let's get into the discussion. As always, this podcast is just for informational and educational purposes only. Every effort has been made to ensure that the information is accurate and reliable at the time of recording. This podcast is not financial advice. We don't take into account your personal circumstances, nor do we provide any guarantees. People may hold positions in the companies and funds discussed in this episode. And further disclosure, I believe you can hear a neighbour of mine. I'm the whippersnipper. You're listening to the Richards Report. And here is my discussion with Six Park co-founder and co-CEO, Pat Garrett.
You're listening to the Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is the Richards Report.
Pat, welcome back for another episode of the Richards Report.
Good to be back, Ted. It seems like quite a bit's happened since we last talked.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. I did mention in the intro that we have someone nearby on the whippersnipper doing some gardening work, so apologies if you can hear that in the background. Pat, it's only been about 4 or 5 weeks since we last caught up, but there's still been a lot going on in such a short period of time. We might kick things off with some things I've noticed that have caught my eye, and we'll speak with what's caught your eye shortly. I've noticed that supermarkets are now overflowing with toilet paper and pasta as the hoarders work their way through their own backlog of supply at home.
Would that include you, Ted? Or is that the ice cream?
We did buy a few extra packets of pasta, but I have been carb loading, so that's no issue there. I see on social media people are making bread, and I'll put myself in that bucket to attempt it at some sourdough. The AFR reports that the sale of sex toys are dramatically up, which I'm not going to touch on anything further there. And Pat, Amazon is actually out of podcast microphones, so I thought that was quite funny.
Any demand for honey from Mount Macedon?
The demand for the
pent up.
Okay, Pat, anything that's caught your eye?
From a personal perspective, I guess it's it was good to hear that surfing's considered exercise, so that surfers are allowed to get in the water. So they've probably been happier than most during this phase. I think on a more serious note, on your first comment, Ted. Somebody I heard the other day, I think correctly say, a day has felt like a week, a week's felt like a month, and the last 5 weeks have felt like a year. And I think everyone's probably feeling that a bit.
Oh, well, you're right. It has been so much crammed into the last 5 weeks. Before we kind of dig into some of the more financial discussion, I just wanted to also mention some of the winners so far, because I feel like if you come out with a half-decent TV show right now, your demand has just doubled or quadrupled. And the best example of this, which was that Netflix series on The Tiger King, which, I think it was okay. I think it was a bit overhyped. I do think they got a little bit lucky with the perfect storm that it was. Pat, I assume...
I might be the only one on the planet who's not watched that.
It's funny, but at the same time, it's incredibly sad. But I think MasterChef has kind of got this perfect storm where they've come out with a new series on gourmet food, and no one can go out. So yeah, they've probably got some tailwinds there. And the other series that I think is kind of in this perfect storm is the series on Jordan, which at the time of recording, we're only two episodes in that everyone's, well, sport lovers are just in need of some form of sport, and out has come this documentary.
For those that may not know exactly what Ted's referring to, it's a Netflix doco on a really pivotal season for the Chicago Bulls, with Michael Jordan as the focal point, but it's all about the team dynamics, and it was really bizarre at the time. It took 20-some years for that footage to be made available.
Well, I might ask you a couple of questions on that, because we're going to finish this discussion off as to kind of what we're reading and watching and listening to, and that is something that I am in the middle of right now, and I'm keen to explore some of those a bit further. But some other winners that I've noticed, apparently sales of trampolines are up as people are just looking for ways to entertain the kids. Dog walkers are everywhere. I've never stepped in so much dog poo, I think. Apparently bread machines were the second fastest growing category in the US in March, which is probably off the back of a bit of people like myself just looking to do things that never really got time to do in the past. And there's two other areas that I think are going quite well right now, and it's quite interesting in that they kind of contradict each other. One of which is running. I've never seen so many people go running, Pat.
And, everyone's out and about.
Yeah, and some of which you can tell they're not a usual runner.
Yeah.
But also people that are getting stuck into the carbs and the booze. So I see some big tailwinds for the weight loss industry. Okay, there was this survey by Cufflinks, which was accurate back in mid-April, where they asked people their thoughts on the market right now. And there were four options that people could choose. Four options here, Pat. I want to hear your thoughts on what you think was the most likely option and the least likely. So one, whether the market has bottomed right now.
Yeah.
Whether we'll reach a new low but rebound within a year.
Yep.
Whether we're entering into a long-term bear market territory.
Yeah.
Or if the person doesn't know what's going to happen in the market.
Yeah.
What do you think was the most common...
The most common answer? I would guess we will reach new lows and rebound over time.
That was at 42%. Most people selected that. What I found quite funny was the least likely was that people don't know, which is in fact,
it's probably the most accurate answer.
That is the most accurate answer. Yeah. And that's the best answer. And I was like, well, it's almost like, that's like the contrarian view out of all this, and that people don't know. But
well, who was it? Charlie Munger over the week, this last weekend.
What did he say?
He said, anyone that says they know what's going to happen is kidding themselves. I think verbatim, nobody knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and it's so true. At 17%, it was, yes, the market has bottomed. So I found it quite interesting that the contrarian view is actually quite optimistic.
Yeah.
Pat, kind of off the back of this, what would be the trigger for you to believe that we are over the worst? The obvious answer is probably a vaccine, but I don't want to anchor you there. What's your thoughts?
So are you framing that over the worst in terms of the market performance?
Well, it's a good question. Probably a point of data that investors would look to to say that we are over the worst.
The reason I asked that is that arguably when the vaccine comes out, one would say that's a real inflection point for being over the worst. But the market will probably not have some visibility as to that, you know, months before. So the question will be, when is that going to get priced into the markets? And the reason that's such a difficult one to sort of use as a frame of when we might have hit the bottom is there's so many other things around stuff you alluded to earlier, Ted, related to employment, whether between now and the time that a vaccine is developed, we still don't know whether we're going to have sort of a mild recession or a deep depression. And so there could be other factors that really overweigh, to some extent, the vaccine at that point that weigh on the market. And a lot of those questions that are unknown right now. I think the answer to your question of when will it feel like we're towards the bottom? Well, first of all, usually it's when you don't expect to feel that. It's when it's unpredictable. But what's very striking right now are the number of important questions to which there are no answers, related to the containment, related to the economic impact, the impact of the unemployment numbers, which have just gone, the pace at which unemployment has risen and the global economy has stopped is just unprecedented in our lives. So when there are some answers to questions about what the impact of that is, markets, as you know, being a student of behavioral economics and finance that you are, markets just don't like uncertainty, broadly speaking. They'd rather have certainty on a bad answer than uncertainty on an answer, full stop. So it's, I think when there's more answers than there are questions, that's when the market's likely to sort of start moving sideways for a little while. And whether or not it's a U-shaped or W or whatever, all these different... Is there such thing as like a T-shaped recovery out?
There are so many different letters.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not so much the day that a vaccine would be approved, because there's many proof points that will be priced in the development and progression of a or many different vaccines along the coming months,
And
possibly years. That's about investing. Pivoting across to money and personal finance, what will be the biggest change in how we think about money after this crisis? Is I think people right now might put more focus on the rainy day fund and increasing their savings rate. But interesting to kind of think how long that will last for, because it doesn't take long for habits to creep back in.
Yeah.
So, Pat, what's your thoughts on how this may change people's behavior towards money?
I think you're right. I think people will certainly take this event as a moment to reflect on what their wealth creation journey looks like and what does retirement look like, and spend a bit of time on the financial wellness. I think what's more likely, or I think what will be hopefully a kind of a longer term dynamic or change out of all this, is that people think of their financial wellness within sort of the broad landscape of their health, of their personal relationships, of where the job fits in their life. So really just causing people to do a lot of reflection on a variety of things, money, but also other aspects of their lives that are being forced on you, because of the quarantine and the isolation. So I think it's just sort of a step back moment for a lot of people on, what they value, what they want to do, and hopefully be a bit more on top of the financial game.
You mentioned that behavioral side before, which made me think of something, the hindsight bias. And I bet you it's not that long into life returning to normal, whenever that is, that we start to hear people talk about how good life in isolation was. And it's probably a bit of that false memory effect and misattribution of what's happened in the past, because ISO life only really tells part of the story. But it's not just about how people can't go out and have beers with their mates or play golf or whatever.
Yeah.
The real story of all this is for many is bloody stressful, as their salary is reduced, as hours are cut. And to be honest, these are the lucky ones that still have a job. And that's ignoring the anyone impacted due to the virus for health reasons. Yeah. So it will be interesting to think of how we look back on this. Pat, this has been identified as a bit of a black swan event. I just want to touch on a black swan event, because it's a black swan event is actually defined as having three characteristics. One, rarity; two, extreme impact; and three, retrospective, in that it can't be predictable.
Yep.
Here's a question for you, Pat. COVID-19 is a black swan event, but if we get a different strand or virus of this in a year or two, or even maybe a decade, will it be a black swan event? Because I don't know if it would tick all three.
Well, I think technically probably not, because one would hope that in the wake of this pandemic, there will be some medical learnings about its origins, how to deal with it, how to prepare for it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they're already talking about, the second wave, right? And it's not related to a new strain, but just the emergence of the strain, and a sort of a rebound. So you'd like to think that if something like this were to occur again in a year, it really wouldn't be a black swan event, because there'd be an element of preparedness to it that you don't normally have, which is we're seeing today, obviously.
Yeah, and that's the countries that went through SARS, like China and Singapore, or the countries that went through MERS, they're actually kind of been through a bit of this before, and possibly handling it better than other countries that haven't experienced anything like this. Let's start to get into the discussion topics, where we did a call out to people through social media to send in questions. Yep. And I've got the first question here from Grant Austin. Grant, good times, Austin, yes. A friend of the show.
Yes.
Why does there appear such a huge disconnect between the market's equity pricing and the economic damage and rhetoric from economists? Because we are seeing that play out, Pat, where sometimes the days where the death rate and infection rates are peaking, yet the share market is rebounding up 6-7%.
Yeah, it's a quite a fascinating time in the markets and the extent of that disconnect. But I think it highlights a couple sort of key things. One, the markets are not particularly rational right now, so it's hard to put too much of an explanation on it. But you have to remember things like, we talk about the market, and that's a complex statement. There's a lot of different types of investors that drive the markets. But, you know, if you expect, just to use an example of a jobless claims number of 6 million and it comes in at 4 million, 4 million is a really big number, right? But if it's not as bad as they think, the market can take that as a real positive. That's just one sort of real simple example of how hard it is to make sense of seeing a lot of negative, sort of terrifying news about the economic impact, and then the market rebounding. It's really complex. And during the early days of a highly disruptive market event like this, there's not a lot of predictability to things.
Yeah, it's not that the market's, it might appear that it's disrespectful and insulting, but the market pays very little attention to what is happening today and mostly looks to what it is thinking is going to happen in the future, which could be next week, even next year or next decade. Yeah. Most fund managers probably look at the predicted PE ratios for 12 months' time rather than what's happening on right now, and market certainly doesn't care about what happened yesterday.
Yeah. I think, sorry to interrupt, Ted, but I think one of the other things that is probably a backdrop to this is we're clearly in a low interest rate environment for quite a while now. That would seem to be a fair assessment. So you're not really going to make much on your cash. And whilst there's downside prospects in the share markets, at least you're going to make some dividends, and if you're reinvesting those. So I think part of what's going on is just a shift in assets into equities at a time when you wouldn't think it would make sense, but there's not really a very attractive alternative to a lot of people, particularly if you've got sort of a medium or long-term view. And that's why, you know, at Six Park, we preach to our investors who, you know, have made a medium or long-term investment plan. You're best served typically to ride through this, rebalance your portfolio, et cetera, reinvest dividends. Going to cash when the interest rates are what they are is typically not a great move. So that's sort of like an underlying level of support for equity markets, regardless of all the bad news.
Mm. Moving on to the next question. This question came from LinkedIn. How many clients have you had wanting to sell portfolios since the recent market decline? They state they don't want specific numbers, but more of a general insight into whether client numbers are looking to weather the storm or sell into it. And further, another question for the ones that did sell: do you think they were overinvested, or did they really see no return from the current climate? And this question came in from Matthew Sinclair, who's actually a lawyer.
Okay. Thank you, Matthew. Good question. We've seen, thankfully, a very low level of churn or clients selling down their whole portfolios.
For those that might not be aware of what Six Park does, could you give us a bit of insight?
Yeah, so Six Park is an online investment management service where we help people get invested in the markets by building a diversified portfolio using ETFs or index funds. So we have defensive and growth assets. So it's not just sort of getting into the equity share markets, it's actually getting a diversified portfolio that can range from a relatively low risk to relatively high risk. And the underlying investment philosophy is, if you have an investment time horizon of sort of a medium to long term, that the best thing is to stay invested, manage your diversification, and keep your costs low. And we have a sort of a human dimension above the automated service, which is an investment committee that sort of keeps an eye on things, especially during times like right now. We have not seen many clients sell down, which we actually think is a prudent investment outcome for most people. And we've actually seen a fair number of accounts top up. That's a personal decision on some people as to whether or not this is a buying opportunity at depressed prices. But most of them are looking to weather the storm. Most that have sold have said, can you actually not close the account and just keep the money on the side? We'll look to get in. That's timing the market. That's sort of a tough one, but some have done that. But far more have sort of topped up accounts as opposed to sell down. The second part of the question, do we think they were overinvested or they really see no return from the current climate? There really are just some people who don't have this stomach for this type of volatility. And as much as we preach time in the market beats time in the market, if it's going to cause a level of anxiety or stress to stay in the market, certainly one option is to go to cash and not, you know, have trouble sleeping every night. But the other thing is, obviously worth noting, is when people perhaps made an investment a year ago, their job situation, their risk appetite, the whole backdrop that sort of informed that investment decision could have been turned entirely on its head in the last month. So if they were to review their risk appetite and whatnot, there are a number of people for whom that could have changed significantly.
Pat, you did mention something at the start of your answer there, which I wouldn't mind just unpacking a little, and that is, Six Parks got from aggressive portfolios to conservative portfolios.
Yeah.
The term conservative portfolios, it means different things to different people. Yeah. Could you give an example of what a Six Park conservative portfolio looks like? Because many people think that a conservative portfolio is Aussie blue chip equities. But an equity or a share isn't a bond. It comes with equity risk.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, could you give...
And there's typically, sorry, just to extend that point, there's typically the assumption that, the dividends are going to continue and the franking credit is going to continue. Both of those can change in an environment like we have now, particularly on the dividend side.
Hello to the Telstra investors.
Yeah, exactly. But typically a conservative portfolio will be more weighted towards defensive assets, obviously, and those would include a cash yield as an asset class, bonds as an asset class, which...
All the sexy asset classes.
yeah, exactly. Arguably, infrastructure, if you took airports out of the equation, and have a defensive nature to them. But it's really, being invested, which some people think of as just shares, but you can actually get different asset classes and manage your risk profile that way.
In Australia, I just wanted to speak about this because we are so fascinated with Aussie property and Aussie blue chip shares. One area that we don't speak about is bonds and fixed income, which other parts of the world, such as parts of Europe, have a very different mindset in terms of the attractiveness of investing in bonds and fixed income. But I just thought I would unpack that a little because they serve an important role in a legitimate conservative portfolio as opposed to... what some people might think is equities, which actually come with equity risk.
Yes.
All right, moving along to the next question. This also came in from LinkedIn, and this is from David Nanfra.
Yeah.
Hi, Pat and Ted. Due to COVID-19, we expect there will be a change in habits of working and consuming goods and services carrying forward. So what changes can you see in how investors think about and plan their investments, particularly for the longer term?
That's a very good question, relevant for pretty much everyone, I think. Thanks for the question, Dave. I think it's probably a question of thinking about changes, not so much about investments themselves, like what do we think about emerging markets now versus a month ago, and what do we think about emerging markets in 2 months, or you know, the Australian share market or whatnot. I think the most likely changes really are related to each person personally about what their wealth journey looks like, what their savings rate is, what their risk tolerance is. It's all those kind of fundamental investment questions that should be part of any backdrop, but less about the actual markets themselves, but more how you would approach investing in those markets, given the nature of how the economic backdrop is going to change.
Yeah. Answering that question somewhat slightly differently in terms of the change of habits of working. Everyone is, you know, now well aware of working and meeting people through Zoom.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're hearing so much about Zoom. I believe at the time of recording, Zoom is now worth more as a business than the total value of the US airline industry, which...
It doesn't surprise me.
Which, personally, you know, I think is a little bit ridiculous. I'm not someone that loves working from home. I am missing the life in the office. So just kind of wanting to speak to the change in habits of working, because when ISO life does finish, I will be getting back into the office.
The end of Dave's question is, he says, particularly, as I'm reading it, particularly for the longer term. I guess what I was trying to get at earlier is the fundamentals of long-term investing really shouldn't change. Yeah. You know, be diversified, keep your costs low. I think those really pretty much stay the same.
Yeah.
It's just how your personal circumstances may have changed in this.
Yeah. The future remains to be uncertain, and diversification protects against an unknown future.
Exactly.
This question's come in from Phil Muscatello, who's actually the host of Shares for Beginners, a great little podcast if people want to check out. It's regarding industry super funds versus retail. The question that he shared through are, what are the differences between industry and retail super funds, including the attitudes of management? I find it difficult to find unbiased information in this area. Pat, there's a bit to discuss here. We could take the conversation in so many different ways. Obviously, a difference between a industry super fund and a retail super fund is the industry super fund is not for profit. People might be familiar with the TV ads that are everywhere of compare the pair. The retail super funds, often bank aligned funds which are for profit.
Yeah.
And fees are important because they're one of the few things that you can control. Pat, something I'd like to discuss in this is something that's in the news right now is the amount of unlisted assets that many of these large industry super funds own.
Yeah.
And the potential consequence that these funds may face if there's a large amount of redemptions due to people taking their $10,000 or $20,000 out of their superannuation fund as the government has allowed.
Yeah.
And what this can mean for the valuation of these unlisted assets. So there's a bit to unpack there.
Well, I think the short answer is probably a lot of downward pressure on the value of illiquid assets. When you have to liquidate illiquid assets very quickly, you tend to not get the value that might be inherent in the underlying assets. I have to say that some of the bad practices that surfaced in the superannuation industry obviously need to be fixed. But I have a measure of sympathy for a construct which is meant to be investing people's money for the long term, and then just completely out of left field, they're being told you have to be able to provide liquidity immediately, especially since, to some extent, a lot of the review of the super industry focused on returns and returns only, and not so much on liquidity. And one of the ways you get returns is by investing in illiquid assets like private equity and things like that. So to have to turn on a dime and provide, you know, a massive amount of liquidity is I'm a little sympathetic to the challenges of that. To answer your question, though, I think it will put there's a lot of things that are going to put downward pressure on the valuation of illiquid assets, among other things, a deteriorating global economy. So I think that'll be interesting to watch how they navigate their way through this as the government's obviously implementing policies to enable people to withdraw some of their super early. I think, you know, like you said, we could go in so many directions. That surfaced, among other things, what some funds were calling balanced and the default funds were actually really, really heavily weighted towards risk assets. And the categorization of assets as defensive were actually, you know, some of those unlisted assets being categorized as defensive was probably not right. And so there's a whole lot of things that I think need to be sort of fixed in this process. But that illiquid assets is one that's going to be a real problem because those valuations are not going to... I think I read in the AFR this morning, they've been written down 5 or 10%. That seems small.
Yeah. For now. Yeah. Fairly conservative. Yeah. So we might move on to the next question because there's so much we could talk to about industry super funds and retail super funds. But yeah. I thought that's quite an interesting topic to discuss as to it's quite current. Pat, I was asked the other day by someone as to what all this means for inflation with what's going around. And because the negative of lowering rates is that if it goes unchecked, you can get hyperinflation. And yeah. whilst inflation has been low here in Australia for quite a while now, if you look at inflation in Latin America, where there have been some dictators that have bullied central banks into printing money to finance extravagances of various sorts, leading to kind of this crazy hyperinflation seen in nations like Argentina, Chile, Peru, and probably most tragic of all, Venezuela, where I believe they've had to stop counting money. They now weigh it. If you want to buy a bottle of water or something like that. Pat, inflation is a very complex issue. We could have a whole episode on it. We could probably have a whole series, but I just
that,
like
that would be riveting for your listeners. Oh. You might want to take that one off your agenda.
Oh, I think I'm not even sure if there's an unsubscribe button, but I'd just like to mention inflation because even though people aren't spending and rates are historically low right now, if we get through this quicker and better than many people assume, it's at some stage interest rates will probably need to go back up because it can't be left unchecked.
It's a very relevant topic, Ted, because inflation is one of the metrics that the central banks look at as to their policy. And prior to this COVID pandemic, one of the big concerns in the market was you had the backdrop of 11 years with, generally speaking, the global economy sort of inching forward, but growing, and low interest rates. And there was a real sensitivity in the market that if inflation started to rise, that the central banks would have to start to raise interest rates to slow it down, and that rising rate environment would be very destabilizing. So that's a very sort of fair concern. I think the reality of what we're in now is that the recovery from what we're going through now is going to take a little while.
Yeah.
The unemployment numbers, obviously, they're very high. You'd expect them to recover to some extent fairly quickly, but I think the inflation question's probably been put off for a little while.
All right, moving along to the next question. This question's come in through email saying that they've got $20,000 that they'd like invested in the market. They're actually ready to go right now, but they're just looking for some signs that the market has settled.
Yeah.
And I was actually thinking this actually represents a very common question that we're quite often asked right now.
Yeah.
Pat, what might they be looking at?
Yeah, it's
which says to them now is a good time to invest.
Yeah, you're right, Ted. We at Six Park, we are getting this question a lot, which has, you know, it's I'm ready to go. Should I get in now or should I wait? We obviously kind of can't and shouldn't answer that personally for people as to get in now or wait, because our overall investment philosophy is it's better to be invested than not.
Especially if you've got a long-term investment.
Especially if you have a long-term investment. And I go back to my point earlier, it's not sort of shares or cash. You can have a more defensive approach to your portfolio construction, which is what our system helps you through via an assessment of questions. I think historically the data would show that waiting on the sidelines typically leads to suboptimal investment return versus getting in the markets. Because if you've got a medium to long-term investment horizon, then if things do continue to get worse and you're reinvesting dividends, you're just buying more at a lower price. And then when the rebound eventually does happen, that sort of has a heightened impact on your the recovery of your portfolio. There are some people who are electing to dollar cost average into the market. And again, while we don't try to get into everyone's personal situation and tell them what to do, we do at Six Park believe that that's a prudent investment strategy.
For those not familiar, a dollar cost averaging approach is where you put in regular, possibly smaller contributions as opposed to a lump sum investments where it's all made at the same time.
Yeah. And that's, again, it's a personal decision, but it's really about probably stress management as much as financial management.
Well, we all need to pass the sleep test.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And as for part of the question, it says, what should they be looking for? I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but the questions around containment, the magnitude of the impact of the economic sort of damage that's being done, the employment damage that's being done. If you want to wait for clarity on that, you will almost certainly have missed the primary bounce back of the market, because the market will see that probably, you know, real time and respond accordingly. So by the time you feel comfortable, you've probably missed out on a significant part of the recovery.
Pat, so much of the discussion that we have with people is about the initial investment.
Yeah.
And I get why people so much focus in on that, because it's so good if the first move of your portfolio is up then down.
Yeah.
But the management ongoing is important too, because rebalancing serves a very important role, which I guess is people don't often speak about.
And correct.
Could you provide a bit of color as to what rebalancing a portfolio looks like?
Yeah. So it is very important and probably underappreciated, and it's one of the things you can do with your portfolio that helps you manage risk. But what rebalancing is if you're invested across different shares or funds or index funds, whatever the case may be, asset classes, over time some will go up and some will go down. And you will have sort of a growth defensive profile that you're targeting, and you will drift over time away from that target kind of growth defensive mix. And rebalancing, as it sort of suggests, is selling a little bit of what's gone up, and therefore you've gone overweight in, to buy a little bit of what's gone down, so that you get yourself back on track with that sort of target growth defensive mix. So what it does is it sort of automates the process of sell high, buy low. You're not selling everything in the process of doing that. You're just periodically, as the name suggests, sort of rebalancing back to your original targets. You don't need to do it very frequently to get the benefits of it a few times a year, because the markets kind of swing up and down over time. You don't need to react every time that you start to incur costs in doing that. And Six Park automates that for the portfolios we manage for our clients. But again, we don't do it every day or every week. That doesn't make sense either.
Pat, the automation of that rules-based approach towards rebalancing and removing the emotional side is important, because over the last few years, when equities have been returning in the vicinity of 15, 20, perhaps even higher percent over the course of 12 months, the temptation...
Yeah.
is to not rebalance, but to actually keep loading up on equities and ignore the role that the defensive asset classes like bonds play in your portfolio. And if that has been your investment philosophy over the last few years, this buffer, this nest egg, this defensive component to your portfolio won't be there to utilize, to use as a as a
source of
capital, yeah, to buy in. And I guess, but the negative of diversifying is that it does make you feel like a bit of a fool sometimes when you're selling something that's going so well. But
And human nature is to buy when things are going up and sell when things are going down. And in investing, that's actually a bad behavior.
Yeah. Now, Pat, the final question for this episode, it comes from me. And it is, what does Six Park mean? Because I get asked it a lot. And I think you're the best one to provide a bit more insight as to the story behind Six Park, because I think it's a fantastic story.
Well, thanks, Ted. Six Park is the address of a family, a family house that my grandparents bought about 65 years ago in the tiny state of Delaware on the east coast of the U.S. near Washington, D.C. And when my grandparents retired and they'd been in the Army, we basically spent all of our years as kids, all the grandkids, and there was a massive rat pack of us. Our summers we spent at Six Park Avenue in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And it was sort of idyllic because we had these 3 months of the summer holiday and we were left to kind of run amok. But what Six Park means to me is the actual house is a big old sturdy house by the beach. And it hasn't changed much in the last 60 years. But as a child, the formative years of my life running around, the emotions or what I feel related to me are safety, trust, resilience, because the house was always sort of manned by adults, being my grandparents and aunts and uncles. So we could sort of run amok and do what we wanted and always felt like, you know, somebody was looking after us. And if there was a big storm, we could get into the house and it might wobble, but it would always be there the next day. And it was also a very welcoming place. It was, we had lots of visitors and whatnot. And, to bring that sort of ramble home a little bit, that's what we want the Six Park service to be for people. We want it to be accessible. We want it for people to trust it and to realize that there are sort of adults looking after things. So that's, for me personally, it resonates just because I think there is a massive need in the market for people to be able to have an investment management service that provides those kind of attributes of safety, trust, resilience. And pleasingly, through this volatile time, Six Park, the business, has held up well, you know, as both the technology as well as, you know, the way that the portfolios perform and the way that our clients are responding to these volatile times and in their behavior. So that's pretty much it.
Now, I think, thanks for sharing that story. Sure. I think it's a great story. And I think listeners would love to hear the story behind the Six Park name. Pat, before we wrap it all up, let's step away from markets and finance and investing with other aspects of life and some of the things that we're reading, watching and listening to. I just want to call out a great TV series that I watched on ABC iView called The Capture, a British show. So highly recommend that. I believe it's like 8 episodes or something like that. I can't work out why there are such fantastic shows on the SBS and ABC apps, but maybe it's just a reflection of my age. Pat, have you seen Ozark season 3?
I'm just about halfway through, three quarters of the way through season 1.
Oh, okay.
I'm way behind you on that one, Ted, but I'm hooked.
Yeah, so I want to do a big shout out to that because that is a fantastic season series that's going on right now. We mentioned at the start about the series that's out on Netflix right now. I think it's called The Last Dance or something about the Bulls last season and Jordan's involvement in that. We've already kind of touched on that. Pat, did you get to see Jordan play live?
I did, both when he played against Washington, where I was living during his formative years. And then he actually was sort of I forget whether he was a co-owner, he was a general manager and player of the Washington, what was it, Bullets, then became the Wizards. So he actually, after he retired, he came back.
he wasn't quite the player he was in Washington, but he was a, you know, he was sort of running the business as well as playing. And even at, you know, 60% of his capabilities, he could still light it up on a night.
Pat, I was born in 1983, and a lot of this is set, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. I grew up, you know, with the Michael Jordan poster on my wall. So I'm incredibly nostalgic about this part of my life. But to be living over in the US and I guess seeing week to week this guy playing and what he did for he and the Bulls, the legacy that they built.
Yeah. Well, my mom and two sisters went to the University of North Carolina, which is where Jordan went. And my sisters were at UNC when he was playing, when he was in college. And back then, guys stayed in college for 4 years. So we saw him go from sort of his freshman year, he was good, but raw. And then his sophomore year, he just turned into a freak. And then he had a couple more years still to go in college. And he hit that game when he hit the game winning shot against Georgetown, which is a Washington, D.C. university. I was the only one of my entire cohort who was a North Carolina fan, mainly because of Jordan. And he hit the game winner against Georgetown in the NCAA tournament. And that was, I don't know, 1982 or 3, something like that.
Gee, that, what a...
It was pretty exciting. It's been pretty exciting watching his career.
This series on Jordan and the Bulls and also the series that is available on Amazon Prime right now on the Australian Test Cricket Team. I think it's called The Test or something like that.
Yeah.
It has made me think that it'd be fascinating if someone, and they might even be doing it right now, is following an AFL team once we get out of isolation in what will be this upcoming AFL season 2020. Because... Yeah. My old industry, the AFL, they have been hit hard and who knows what the season may look like. Some teams are going to stuff this up completely and some will succeed. And
you don't have to name names, Ted, but are you seeing...
Where are you going with this?
No, seriously, are you seeing AFL teams sort of navigate right now proactively a really tough time and some that seem to be sitting on their thumbs? And would you expect there to be, you know, commensurate consequences down the road?
It's a bit unknown. I think it's a lot is going to have to do with how a team's culture is able to absorb and manage and get the guys through this, the players through this, because it's all well and good to be a good player, a good trainer when the eyes are on you. But when the eyes aren't on you, what's your behavior like?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be no preseason. There's going to be a couple of weeks to get up to speed and then straight back into it.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to be a shortened season. So you can't afford to kind of roll into this. And I think there will be some teams that stuff it up.
Yeah.
And
presumably that's a combination of sort of the front office as well as the player leadership?
I'm not sure. It's very hard to talk about off field, but the financial security won't be there.
Yeah.
So teams, like every business in Australia, have got to really look at their costs. But what I do have is experience on field, and one of the best and easiest ways to look after your off field position is by winning games on field, because it doesn't take long for members and sponsors to jump back on board. If you don't get that on-field success, it's very hard to build a financial stable situation because professional sporting teams in Australia, unlike the US, aren't run for a profit.
Yeah.
They don't have owners that are happy to just keep tipping money in. They're built and run to win premierships. So the quickest way out of this financial position, which pretty much every team is in, is to win on field.
Puts a lot of pressure on.
Yeah. Okay, that's it for this episode. Pat, thank you for joining for another chat.
Thanks, Ted.
Pat, I think we're going to have to do this again at some stage in the future. Probably won't be long before, because it's only been 4 or 5 weeks. So I think there'll be probably a lot more to talk about in 4 or 5 weeks' time. And I'm not going to pretend I've got a crystal ball.
And, I don't think anyone does. And I would encourage the any listeners out there to. It's obviously interesting to watch the news, but don't try to overread too much into stuff because. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, that's good advice. If you'd like to find out anything more about Six Park related, please check out the website sixpark.com.au. You can also find Pat on social media. Pat, what's your tag on Twitter?
That's a great question.
I probably should have given you the heads up. But I was, Pat Garrett. Pat Six Park, I believe you are.
I think it's at Pat Six Park.
There can't be too many Pat Six Parks.
No, there wouldn't be.
Okay, all right. You can hit me up on Twitter at TedRichards25. Okay, thanks to everyone that listens in and shares these episodes with friends and family. Really appreciate it. Stay safe, people, and see you next time on The Richards Report.